accession number 15240, reel 4.
Mr. Hamilton, reel 4. You were just saying you were perfectly capable of getting from A to B.
Yes, but of course, going back to what I was saying earlier, Admiral Ramsay could not possibly allow a ship with only one propeller to lead the invasion. It was very sad, but it made no difference.
Did you get any incoming fire off Normandy?
You mean enemy fire?
Yes.
No, we didn't. In fact, it was... I don't want to make light of it, of course, because it was a tremendous undertaking, but in our part of it, once we had led our brigade to the beach and they had gone ashore and we had laid then taken over the duties of traffic policemen off the coast, we were not involved in hostilities, really, only in organisational matters, with the sea literally covered with ships of every conceivable description coming and going, full, empty, whatever. Amazing. It was just like a colossal regatta. In fact, we used to fire small charges to stun a few fish every morning so we could have fresh fish for breakfast.
Any other memories from Normandy?
Well, I did go ashore later when the soldiers, poor fellows, had done their stuff and buy a few boxes of camembert and that sort of thing to remember the day. Now, I must not be flippant because it was a tremendous undertaking and some of the poor chaps on the other beaches, particularly the American beaches, where they were just blown to pieces in the sea and had no hope of scaling the cliffs. Ghastly business. Ghastly business. We had a very cushy job.
What happened to you then in the last year of the war, after Normandy?
Well, by this time, my hearing and sight had both deteriorated due to the Malta bombing. You probably know that every time there was an air raid, the entire civilian population retreated into caves. And blast is an extraordinary thing. It can literally blow one eardrum in and take the other one out at the same time. I am extremely fortunate in that I was not seriously damaged, but I am slightly deaf and my eyesight is not as good as it should be. Well, this I reported to the Admiralty and they said, well, they appointed me to Dartmouth. That was the back to Dartmouth, which was a great honour on the staff, that is. And eventually I saw NA2SL, who said, I'm afraid you will never command another ship, and the only civilised thing we can do is to say to you, you can stay on in the service and prop up a dockyard wall until you are retirement age, or you can go now and learn something else and have a new life, and we will give you a small pension. And I burst into tears in the Admiralty because I was very keen. I loved the Navy, had met the most marvellous people, been inspired by people like Cunningham and Vian, and had done my best to do well for my country. And it was with the utmost reluctance that I took the decision to go, because the thought of propping up a dockyard wall for the rest of my life did not seem to me to be very constructive.
Did you then get another job in the Navy?
No, when I I then fought the 1945 parliamentary election, actually, while I was still in the service, as a liberal, I may say, now Liberal Democrat. Good plug. And after my service as a house officer at Dartmouth, I was given this voluntary retirement.
Can you tell me about why you decided to fight the 45 election as a liberal? And about the feeling about the country politically at the end of the war?
Well, I had done a little study of politics, but I was disenchanted by the then government, obviously, or the pre-war government, I should say. It was perhaps a foolish decision, but I was very young. The thing is that the whole country was, as I'm sure, well, you are young yourself, but the whole country was determined to get rid of the old guard, and they voted Labour in droves to get rid of the previous government. It was as simple as that. There was not much room for a discussion of policies. It was felt that I had a reasonable chance, and for that reason Sir William Beveridge, who in fact invented Social Security, as you know, was sent up to support me, as he couldn't go everywhere, poor man. And the local papers thought that Blackpool, which had two members of Parliament, that we might win the North Division and the Tory Party would win the South Division. I was defeated by Toby Lowe, subsequently Lord Aldington, and we have exchanged correspondence quite recently. It was an election fought in the best British traditions. We stayed in the same hotel. We had breakfast together, went out and slanged each other all day, and then returned and had a drink at night before we went to bed.
This was Blackpool North, you said?
Blackpool North. I went to the... this is not really a political interview, but I went to the Tory party and said, I would like to be a member of Parliament and try and do something creative. What are the requirements? And the first question I was asked was, what is your unearned income? And I said, I'm sorry, but that doesn't appeal to me as a question at all. I went to the Labour Party and I said, do you really mean production of all, nationalisation of all means of production, distribution and exchange? That's clause four, of course. And they said, of course we mean it. But I went to the Liberals and I said, look, I want to be a member of Parliament, and what are the qualifications? And this will amaze you. The man said, I remember it well, he said, we only ask that you should be sincere. I must admit that I nearly burst into tears.
Can you say more about the mood of the people who'd been in the services, the political mood of the people who'd been in the services, perhaps in comparison with civilians in that 45 election? What kind of political mood had the war created for the servicemen on one hand and the civilians on the other? Was there any difference?
Well, honestly, I don't know, because I have to admit, I was, I don't know what the word is, totally green and unaware. I mean, I had been 100% absorbed in the war, and I knew absolutely nothing of the feelings of the civilian population. Obviously, one knew that they were going through hell, and they had no food, and the London people bombed, and all this business. I had a wife who was in the Women's Air Force, Royal Air Force, who at one stage was in two different bomber stations and finally was appointed by mistake as an RAF corporal. And she never told anybody, and she was actually given an RAF job by mistake in London. And I know a little bit from her about the behaviour of the civilians and how marvellous they were, but I have no knowledge whatever of the political feelings of the civilians.
Did you personally feel politically in that 45 election that it was time for a new start?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I mean, one knew that, I think. It's not a situation on which really I'm fit to elaborate. I don't know much about it. I was not then a political animal, and of course, during the war, one was totally involved in winning it. I had a certain reaction. My parents were staunch conservatives in the West Country, and I'd reacted against the attitude adopted by many of their supporters, but it's not something on which I can elaborate with authority at all.
Any personal memory of VE Day or VJ Day?
Well, VJ Day, yes, because actually on VJ Day, of all days, I received an appointment as Staff Officer Operations Fleet Train. Now, that is an outfit which, in the Far East, provided the fleet with everything it needed: ammunition, fuel, films for the cinema, potatoes, whatever, everything, so that the ships could remain at sea doing their stuff without having to go back all the way to Sydney for replenishment. This outfit was based in the Admiralty Islands at Manus, and it was there that I was appointed to be Staff Officer Operations. This was something totally different to anything I had done before, and I regard it as a great compliment. I felt rather sorry for the sailors who had to remain at sea regardless, because if we were efficient, they would have no need ever to return to harbour. However, I got the appointment on VJ Day. And I rang up the Admiralty and said, "Do you really want me to go? Because the war is over." And they said, "You must obey the last order." And so I actually got into an aeroplane and got as far as Sydney. And I changed aeroplanes, and I was about to go to Manus when a chap came running across the airfield waving a piece of signal pad, and the aeroplane stopped taking off, and I was told to get out because my appointment had been cancelled. So that was my contribution to the war in the Far East.